hoc docket, we will hear both of those, and we will go right into the second one after we complete the first one. Then we'll take a short break to before we hear our 10:30 case. We have one case on our 10:30 docket. If the clerk will please announce counsel for the parties. Thank you. All right, Mr. Jones.
Yes, ma'am. Can I approach?
Yes.
Hey, police court.
My name is Lindy Jones, and this is I'm sure you've already read the briefs, so I'm not going to bore you with going through the facts a lot. But let me say that this is one of the, to me, more straightforward cases I've argued in the Court of Appeals, in that since we're talking about a summary judgment, A, that simplifies it a lot, and B, since we really only have 3 points, two of which are very related, I think it's easy to argue and easy to see what our position is in this particular situation. There basically were 3 promissory notes executed by 2 by Energico, 1 by Green Meadows. They were both guaranteed by Stephen Knight. There were guarantees that were executed. They were undated, but they said they were effective as of January the 24th, I believe, of 2008. We pled no consideration for the guarantees, and we have summary judgment evidence in that Mr. Knight in his affidavit says that he was given no consideration. There's 2 things in this case, since I'm usually arguing for the bank, that's unusual for me. First of all, normally we know that there's case law that says that when a bank officer testifies that this is the amount owed on the note, that's good enough. You can't say that's conclusory, you can't say that's hearsay. That's always been upheld in almost all circumstances to be sufficient. But what we have here is something different, and that is our first point, and that is that there's a genuine issue as a material fact as to what amount is owed. And basically what that boils down to is a part of this loan transaction, Mr. Knight in Energico borrowed $559,000, but really all but $200,000 of it was funded. $200,000 had to be put into a CD at the bank. That all sounds well and good. I think that's a common banking practice. The problem is you get to the point where, and we have summary judgment evidence to this effect, that Mr. Knight's saying, look, take the CD, apply it to the debt, and let's work on the difference. Won't do it. We can't tell when that happened. So what we did in the lawsuit is we sent a deposition notice asking for the person or persons with the most knowledge about this loan. The person they produced was Teresa Woods, the only one that, near as I can tell, knew anything about the loan. She had had 1 conversation with Mr. Knight. So what we ask, if we go through the summary judgment evidence, and this is outlined in our brief, so I won't bore you with the cites because they're right there in the brief. The woman that supposedly had the most knowledge about this loan, these are the things that she did not know. She did not know how it came to pass that the CD was applied to the loan. There are no bank officer notes or emails regarding the CD application. There was no notice of the CD being applied to the loan given to my clients. She did not know how the application of the CD affected the interest rate. She didn't have any documents to show the interest calculation. She didn't know if the interest rate was the default rate or the stated note rate, or if it changed at any time. She didn't know when the CD was applied. And with all this, it shows she had no personal knowledge. We did everything we could to try and figure out what is owed on the note, and we couldn't get it. So whereas there is the case law that says, look, when the officer says this is what's owed, I think this case has got to be the exception, where we have done everything we can to try to adduce evidence as to how did you come up with this number, and we can't. Appellee obviously shoots at us saying, well, you didn't say it's incorrect. Well, we can't. They won't give us enough information that we can do any of our own calculation, because without a $200,000 credit, and knowing when that was applied, it's impossible. This sort of leads us into our second point of error, and that is basically the guarantee.
Before you go into that, though, let me ask one question. Can you at least tell that the $200,000 was applied at some point?
You probably can. And the reason is the note started at $559,000, and so you see the judgment balance. But the problem is you can't tell the calculation. So saying I owe, $300,000 or $400,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 really doesn't cut their burden of proof. Their burden of proof is to prove what is owed. They couldn't produce anybody for deposition to do that.
And so what summary judgment evidence did you offer to either contradict or prove up the lack of knowledge on the part of...
We offered the excerpts from Teresa Woods, the bank officer who we deposed. And we listed out on two pages, I think it's page 6 and 7. I'm sorry, I cut off the page and I don't have it right here. But it's listed out indented paragraphs. It shows you the list of A through H things that we pointed out that she did not know. So our second point is that the liability of the guarantor. And again, this is the most common thing that comes up. I see it all the time from the bank standpoint. And that is, if you have a loan based on a structure that the guarantor is going to guarantee the debt, that's sufficient consideration. Even if you have the guarantee signed on or before the date of the loan, that's sufficient consideration. What you don't have here is you don't have any allegation that they alleged any consideration to the guarantor. And with the documents, it's impossible to tell. Because again, what we have is we have notes that were signed on May the 11th, 07, January the 31st, 08, and January the 28th, 08. What we have is a guarantee, the two of them that are signed, and they say the same thing. There's no date on them. But typed in, it says, both effective as of January the 24th, 07. Well, it's impossible to tell what that connects up to, whether it's the same loan or anything else. And I understand, this is a close call. If I was on that side of the bench, I don't know what I would do with that. But I can tell you that normally in a summary judgment, since everything is indulged in the non-movement's favor, it seems to me in this situation, they're going to have to meet their burden of proof, which they haven't done on this issue. Because we have summary judgment proof directly from in Mr. Knight's affidavit, which is in the record at page 184, and I believe it's paragraph 2, he said he received no consideration. So that leaves us to the third point. I know I'm
but
sort of covering...
Isn't that a legal conclusion on the part of that witness as to whether there was consideration received?
It was unobjected to, but that's right. Consideration is right. That's one of those things that is real close. If you say, I got nothing of value, and whether or not that's a legal conclusion of consideration, I don't know. It's a close call because consideration has not only a expert meaning under the law, but also has a lay meaning. A lay meaning, I didn't get anything. And that's what he said. I didn't get anything. So that leaves us to the third point, which to me would be the easiest one to cite out of all of these. And that is, they did not segregate the attorney's fees. And normally I understand, and they've argued the cases, and I've argued the cases before in the Court of Appeals about inextricably intertwined. The problem is they don't connect the dots. If Judge Livingston guarantees my debt, I understand that. Judge Livingston guarantees Mr. Berry's debt, I understand that. But what they did is now they suddenly made me liable for Mr. Berry's debt, and Mr. Berry liable for my debt. There's no way to do that. There's no way to basically undo that. And that's jumping the biggest point on the attorney's fees issue, and that is whether it's controverted. If you look at my summary judgment affidavit, because this is mine, because I was trial counsel, I say that the fees were not reasonable and necessary. Now, they attack that saying, oh, that's conclusory. Well, any opinion as to fees is conclusory. You always, do you have an opinion? The answer to that is yes. What is that opinion? It's always a conclusion. You've got to remember that the other thing they argue is that somehow we waive that. We can't waive it. The burden of proof on this issue is on them, not on me. So not only did we object to it, not only did we controvert it, the visiting judge sitting in the court just said, oh, well, I'm going to grant this. And I think he thought we would never appeal it, and I wouldn't have liked to appeal it, but I think this is so far afield from what the judge should have done, they literally left me no choice.
I have a question, though. Are we maybe mixing apples and oranges? It appears to me that the issue of segregation of attorney fees more relates to a situation where one defendant is sued for maybe two or three different causes of action, as opposed to this case where you've got really mixed causes of action against different defendants.
Well, and I understand that. And there's a great line of cases on, are these attorney's fees recoverable under these cause of actions? And if they're not, you can only get the attorney's fees under which the law allows recovery of attorney's fees. The difference is, you got to think about, to me, you've got to think about the causes of action. The cause of action against the bank is against, if I'm EnergyCo, me, and against you as the guarantor. The cause of action, the other cause of action is from the bank against Mr. Berry as Green Meadows and you as the guarantor. There's no way that there's a cause of action that somehow ties whatever they spent trying to collect the fee from Green Meadow that I should have to pay. And there's no way that he should have to pay the attorney's fees that were used to collect the money against me. So while I understand your question, I think it is really sort of a cause of action deal. I think it is any time when you have the burden on showing something's reasonable and necessary, it has to be just that. It has to be reasonable in amount, which we've controverted. It has to be necessary. It is not necessary to sue Green Meadow to collect from EnergyCo. It is not necessary to sue EnergyCo to collect from Green Meadow. So for those reasons, we'd ask that the court reverse and remand the case.
I have a question. Counsel? Counsel, Mr. Jones?
I'm sorry.
I have a question. So is your objection really segregation, or is it more joint and several liability?
Well, it didn't really joint and several liability other than that's how the judgment was granted. Because there is no joint or several liability. They can't show any document, any cause of action that shows joint and several liability. I have one question. Are y'all cheering for Texas Tech or Texas? Because I know the two of y'all, one went to undergraduate school there and one went to law school at the other place. So, I don't know. To me, it's the same thing. It is a segregation issue. That's what I think it is, because it is, you're going to have to break out the attorney's fees that go with the cause of action. And there is no cause of action between these two, Green Meadow and EnergyCo, so there's no cause of action there. It has to be segregated out. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to walk away from the podium. I didn't understand that question. I still didn't hear whether you're cheering for Texas or Texas Tech.
How about both?
That's going to be hard this week.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Berry.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chad Berry. I represent the Frost National Bank. I agree that this is a pretty simple, straightforward case. I don't think that the summary judgment evidence that was provided to the court at the summary judgment level, nor the things that have been set forth in the appellant's brief, really changed the outcome. This is a straightforward banking situation where we have three notes. We have two guarantees. And the bank has proven, as a matter of law, how much is due and owing on the notes. And unfortunately for Mr. Knight, he is liable on the guarantees. We had three notes in this case, and they are at three different times. We have a May 11th note, which is the first EnergyCo note. We have a January 24, 2007 note. I'm sorry, that's the first Knight guarantee, which is related to the first EnergyCo note. I would just point out to the court that on the guarantee, the first guarantee, which is at the court's record 101 to 104, the last paragraph on 104 sets forth the date of the guarantee, and it is January 24th of 2007. That date is, again, set forth. I understand that there's not a date on the first page of the guarantee, but we do have a date, and it says the guarantee is dated January 24, 2007, so I don't really think that's in dispute as to when the guarantee was executed. The second Energeco note was January 31st of 2008. Then we have the Green Meadow note, which is January 28, 2008. And we've got the second night guarantee. That's at the clerk's record 129 to 132. And if you look at page 132, again, we've got this guarantee is dated January 25th, 2007. So we've got some bright line dates there when the guarantees were executed related to, and if you look at the, I guess, kind of the what I'll call the header on both guarantees, you can see what those guarantees relate to with respect to the underlying indebtedness that was owed to Frost Bank. So those are the documents, and I really think that part of the issue here is, what do the documents say? And counsel has talked about, well, Ms. Woods didn't say this and Ms. Woods didn't say that. And really, it doesn't matter. What do the documents say? The documents govern the relationship. And I find, as a banking lawyer, that's the problem I deal with week in, week out, that there's always some creative theories about, well, this should have been done, or this should have been applied, or A, B, C, and D, and I seem to deal with that over and over, and my question is typically, what do the documents say? Do the documents address that? And Frost Bank's documents address all of these issues. They address when could they set off the CD. That's set forth in the commercial security agreements. And again, the security agreements really aren't an issue in this appeal, but if you look at the language, it talks about set off. It talks about when they can be set off. It talks about that the bank could hold that as collateral and didn't have to cash it in. I agree that Mr. Knight asked for it to be cashed, and the bank really didn't want to do that because they wanted to have some collateral. But again, the documents govern the relationship. And with respect to the notes, the bank had applied all offsets and credits to the indebtedness. The defendants received every benefit they were entitled to on the monies that were utilized from the CD. And David Spadafora put on an affidavit at the summary judgment level that says, here's how much is due and owing under the note. And what I don't see in the appellant's brief is pointing out, where's the controverting evidence to Mr. Spadafora's affidavit? Mr. Spadafora proved that there was a note, that there was a guarantee, that the defendant was the maker of the note and executed the note, that Mr. Knight executed the guarantee, that Frost National Bank is the legal owner and holder of the note, and that there was a balance due and owing. And under the Austin versus Countrywide Home Loans, that's generally the test on is there a note, we've proven up the documents, how much is due and owing. Mr. Spadafora, who's a vice president of Frost Bank, set forth how much was due and owing. And again, the summary judgment record, there's not any evidence that says, well, we don't think that amount is due and owing. And I disagree with appellant's counsel that says, well, we tried and we couldn't do anything. Well, if you made payments or if you think something was misapplied, typically you'll go in and say, well, I don't think the amount is due and owing because A, B, C, and D. Here are the reasons why I think that amount is wrong. And we just don't have any of that in this summary judgment record. Mr. Knight.
Isn't that the purpose of deposing Teresa, the other banker? I mean, she was so vague in her responses as to how the outstanding balance was calculated. Isn't that a problem for your client?
I don't think that it is a problem because, again, this Woods isn't the one that put on the affidavit for summary judgment. I understand that they wanted to get some information about that. Part of the problems with the bank is you put somebody on with some institutional knowledge. They've gone through the file. They're trying to get some information to the other side on what has happened. And Ms. Woods testified to what she prepped herself and she testified. But again, at the end of the day, their complaints are about Mrs. Woods and they're not about Mr. Spadafora's summary judgment affidavit. So I really don't think that it is a problem because again, a lot of the complaints that they have about Ms. Woods are really resolved by what is contained within the document. What is contained with the interest rate. Mr. Spadafora sets forth what the initial interest rate was on the loans and what the post-judgment interest rate was. So this confusion about the interest rate, I don't understand that either because Mr. Spadafora says in his affidavit, the initial interest rates on the first note was 9.25%. The post-maturity rate is 18%. The second Energeco note, the interest rate was 9%. The post-maturity rate was 18%. And then on the Green Meadow note, the initial rate was 8.5% and the post-maturity rate was 18%. And again, he set that in his affidavit. So if there's some, again, it seems pretty clear on what the rate was. All the offsets and credits were given, and Mr. Spadafora set forth per note how much was due and owing on each separate note. So with respect to the note, again, there's not a requirement in a summary judgment case that the bank has to do some detailed calculation of the balance due and owing. We cited that Stuckey versus Noble, which is in our brief. Again, there's not some complex computation. Again, I think that with respect to summary judgment, there's some things that the appellant could have done to raise a fact issue if in fact either a representative of the entity wanted to do that or Mr. Knight. And if you look at the summary judgment evidence, we only have one affidavit, and Mr. Knight's really kind of the guy on point for the entities and for himself personally, but we just don't have any evidence from Mr. Knight that's controverting what's owed, what the interest rate is, and how much is due and owing. I want to address the consideration issue that's been raised in the brief. There's a couple things here that the court needs to look at with respect to the consideration. Again, what does the guarantee say with respect to consideration? What are the obligations of the guarantor? What is the relationship between the parties? The guarantees are reciprocal, and I'm going to reference the first guarantee, which is at CR 101 to 104. The very first paragraph, Mr. Knight has agreed. It says, for good and valuable consideration, guarantor absolutely and unconditionally guarantees full and punctual payment of the satisfaction of the indebtedness of borrower to lender and the performance and discharge of all borrower's obligations under the note and the related documents. This is a guarantee of payment and performance and not of collection. Also, it's important to note that guarantee's liability is unlimited and guarantor's obligation is continuing. These are things that Mr. Knight agreed to in the guarantee. His promise was given as part of the transaction, and money was loaned to these entities. The guarantee debt, the consideration for the debt supports a guarantee. The loan was made. These facts are not in dispute. We don't have any evidence from Mr. Knight in the summary judgment record that says Energy Co. didn't receive any money, that Green Meadow didn't receive any money. We just don't have any evidence that supports that. The loan was made, and the underlying consideration for the promissory notes also supports a consideration for the guarantee.
Is there not a problem with the fact, though, that the second Energy Co. loan was funded after the date of the first guarantee?
Not at all, because we've got the First Commerce Bank case deals with that, First Commerce Bank versus Palmer, which is a Texas Supreme Court case. Guarantee agreements at post-date are enforceable without requirement of additional consideration. The court dealt with that issue there and said, look, if you've got an initial transaction where we've got the guarantor had executed the document, we have a subsequent loaning of money, we're still going to have some consideration there because the underlying loan was made. So I think the court's addressed that. Again, consideration of the principal sufficient to bind the guarantor, especially when the guarantee was contemplated and executed as a part of the original transaction. Again, I don't think there's any summary judgment evidence controverting, number one, that the guarantee was executed, number two, that it was executed in conjunction with this transaction. So I think the consideration arguments fail as a matter of law. There is consideration there. I agree with the court that Mr. Knight just can't say, well, I didn't receive any consideration. Again, that it's conclusory. It is a legal conclusion, a factual conclusion. He's got to say why. Again, that as a banking lawyer, that's something I deal with all the time is dealing with conclusory affidavits that don't say because. They say, I didn't get the money, or I didn't do this, or I didn't do that, and they're conclusory on their face. There's not any underlying facts to address that. With respect to the attorney's fees, I think the law is real clear. Again, I think this is a really easy call because I think that the appellant is 180 degrees wrong on what they're arguing. Segregation is real clear. There's two big cases out of the Texas Supreme Court that deal with segregation. And Stuart Title versus Sterling really kind of started it in 1992 that says, look, if you've got multiple defendants and you've got some defendants that settle, you've got to address that and the segregation of fees. And in that case starts talking about the interrelation of claims, same transaction, prosecution or defense entails proof or denial of essentially the same facts, citing the Flint and Associate versus Intercontinental Pipe and Steel case. You know, we don't have, in our case, we don't have facts where we have defendants that settled, so that doesn't apply. We do have interrelated documents. We have interrelated cause of action. And Stuart Title also talks about facts and circumstances are intertwined to the point of being inseparable. Okay, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Then we go on to CHOPPA, the Tony Guillo Motors versus CHOPPA, which went back and looked at Stuart because I think the courts of appeal were hearing everything is inexplicably intertwined. And I think you had a lot of lawyers out there that were using recoverable and unrecoverable cause of action to say, well, it's all intertwined. I should be paid all my attorney's fees, even if I've got a DTPA claim or tort claim, and I've also got a breach of contract claim. Well, the court in CHOPPA says, well, look, here's what Stuart says. You know, it says if you got a division of fees between recoverable and unrecoverable, you know what? You got to separate those out. And that's what the court said. But what I think is interesting, what CHOPPA, the court said, Sterling was certainly correct that many, if not most, legal fees in such cases cannot and need not be precisely allocated to one claim or another. This court in AMX Enterprises LLP versus Master Realty Corp. Addressed a constitutional lien claim, a breach of contract claim, and a prompt payment claim in a construction case, and found that all of those fees were so intertwined that they need not be segregated. So let's look at the facts of this case. I put on an attorney's fees affidavit which sets forth the items that were done, the legal matters that were performed on behalf of the Frost National Bank. And my attorney's fees affidavit is from 147 to 150 in the clerk's record. So if you go through and look at that, this is an issue in any breach of contract case. You've got a plaintiff's original petition that applies to everybody. You've got summary judgment that applies to everybody. You've got a deposition that applies to everybody. It is very difficult in this case that we're not trying to say who should pay what. And what I mean by that is you've got legal matters that were performed for the benefit of Frost National Bank against all the defendants. And it was essentially a one-for-three deal. You've got a plaintiff's original petition that's dealing with Green Meadow, Energico, and Mr. Knight. And that was a one-shot deal, and those fees are going to be applicable. And you see that throughout my attorney's fees affidavit. You've got legal matters that addressed all three of those. And again, there's not a requirement of segregation in this case because we're dealing with the same set of issues. I had to take a deposition of Mr. Knight to deal with all of our breach of contract cases. I don't think that the law requires me to say, well, I spent 30 minutes talking to Mr. Knight about his part of the case, and I spent an hour and a half on Energico. So in closing, Your Honors, I would just say that there's not a requirement for segregation in this particular case, and we would ask that the summary judgment be upheld.
Isn't the only, I guess your only theory or basis for joint and several liability, though, on the attorney fees is based on the guarantees? Is that?
Well, the guarantee.
I mean, is there two separate notes with two separate entities?
Each of the notes have an attorney fees provision in there that require them to pay if those documents are enforced. So with respect to the joint and several nature of the fees, you know, I don't know if the court was wanting to see, well, they should all be several. They're all required to pay those fees. I mean, they just are. The work that was done for the deposition is for, again, Energico was the same work that was done on the deposition for Energico. And, I mean, they are what they are. I don't know if the court's wanting to see some different language in the summary judgment order that talks about the division, but you have a core amount of fees that were incurred because of all three defendants.
All right, thank you.
Let's say you had a fourth note that was not guaranteed by me and was
executed by Snowflake Inc. And you threw them into that lawsuit. Is everybody going to get the same percentage of attorney's fees? Is everybody liable for all of the attorney's fees?
Well, I would enter your question with, it depends on what the claims are against Snowflake, but if they're a breach of contract or a note case. If we've got a note case and let's say I had to go take a deposition of Snowflake, and where I took a deposition of Mr. Knight and he also had some connection with Snowflake, I think, yes, the fees are all, but, well, then I don't think Snowflake, it would depend. If I had to take a separate deposition and file a separate summary judgment against Snowflake, then no, I don't think those fees would be a part of all that. I think it
is because Knight guaranteed all of the notes. That's why you say the attorney's fees don't have to be separate because it all involves Knight?
No, ma'am. I'm just talking about the legal work that was performed on behalf of Frost Bank as a function of all three defendants. Let's say that I had to take a deposition of Knight and the other two, and I had to take a deposition of Snowflake. I don't think the deposition of Snowflake, which would be separate, I don't think those would be attributable to the other three defendants. Does that make sense? If you're having to separate it, even if it's a breach of contract claim, but I had to do separate legal work to only deal with the claims of Snowflake, then yes, I think it could be segregated, but those aren't the facts here. The plaintiff's original petition, the motion for summary judgment, that was a single act that was done on attorney's fees that all three of those defendants were required to pay the attorney's fees that were incurred. If I had to go file a separate summary judgment or petition or some other deal with, let's say, affirmative defenses that were only asserted by Snowflake, then yes, I think that could be segregated out. Well, again, I think my answer would be, what kind of legal work was done that was attributed to all four at the same time? If there was a separate, let's say that I drafted requests for admission separately to Snowflake. No, I don't think that the other defendants have to pay for that.
The request for admission that you drafted for Energico was the same request for admission that you drafted for Remodel?
Yes, they were primarily the same thing. I did them all at the same time. They all went out at the same time. I lumped that time together and then separated it out on drafting all those documents.
And if Snowflake had been in there, you would have done the request for admission. Would you have done the request for admission for Snowflake at the same time since Knight didn't hear anything that night? I'm just trying to figure out.
If we're talking about it, it's a breach of note, and it may be different, because the only way I can answer that is I can just say what my practice is as an attorney, and I typically will address the defendants and try to address the legal work if it's affecting all, you know, who the defendants are and what are the issues involved. I don't know how else I can answer it other than that. No, ma'am. No, ma'am. There was only one CD, and I think that was with respect to Mr. Knight. And I'm drawing a blank on if it was an entity CD or if actually it was Mr. Knight's CD, and I don't recall off the top of my head on the application of that. There was a CD, yes. That is correct. Well, I do know the date that it was applied to the note, yes. Correct. Yes, there is a date in which the CD was applied, and yes, the bank calculated the interest due and owing on the notes after the offset of the CD was made. Is that answering your question? I think at the timing of the summary judgment, I don't know that in Ms. Woods' affidavit, I don't think that Ms. Woods had the date, or I would have to look back at her deposition to see if she testified about the date in which it was applied. I'm not sure that she did, and I don't recall off the top of my head whether she had testified to that.
referencing that this was a single petition and a single summary judgment motion, but all of them could have been brought separately.
Well, they could, but I just don't think that promotes judicial economy. And really, in real world mechanics, because I keep combating issues like this, the effect of that's going to be is that the courts are going to be three times as busy, and they're going to have three separate cases. And if this is not the first time I've had to deal with the segregation issue. And yes, you're exactly right. They could be three, but I just don't think it promotes. I think you've got three cases as opposed to one case to be filed with the district courts.
Thank you, Mr. Berry. Mr. Jones, and let's give Mr. Jones an additional 1 minute because we did ask some questions of Mr. Berry.
Some excellent questions. Let me go back through and let's go back through what Mr. Berry just said. As to your question about could these have been separate petitions, absolutely. Why? Because they're different causes of action. There is a cause of action based on the two notes against EnergyCo and that guarantee. There is a cause of action against Green Meadow, that note, and that guarantee. That's what I'm talking about in segregation. They've got to do it. Let's take another example to go along with what Justice Daffino said. In my example before where Judge Livingston was nice enough to guarantee my loan, let's say mine was a car loan for $5,000. I bought an old beat-up used car. The note she guaranteed for Mr. Berry was to build this building for $50 million. The precedential value that this court would let stand if they let this judgment stand is all of a sudden I'm liable for the attorney's fees to collect the money from Mr. Berry for $50 million. That can't possibly be allowed to stand. So when you look at what he said the defendants received every benefit, the appellants. No summary judgment evidence as to that. No summary judgment evidence as to when that CD was applied. None. No summary judgment evidence as to when the interest rate was kicked up from the stated note rate to the default rate. Because it's not after maturity. That's right. The Spatafora affidavit says that. The problem is the default rate is just that, a default rate. One of the ways to default is not pay the note at maturity. Another way to default is not pay your payments as they come due. And the note is then accelerated, and it kicks in the default rate. We have no way to calculate that. Absolutely none. We asked for the person with most knowledge. Spatafora, we objected to his testimony because he doesn't have personal knowledge. If he was, we want the person or persons with most knowledge for that deposition. What did they produce? They produced Teresa Woods. What did she know about it? Diddly squat. She looked at a file, that's all she knew. She didn't know anything else. It puts us into an impossible burden. He wants me to tell you what pocket his pen is in. I don't get to search him. I don't get to know. I can't see. He won't give me any of the numbers. He won't go through an x-ray machine. But he wants to make me go back and tell him what pocket his pen's in. That is an impossible burden. No defendant, no appellant should be put to that burden. So is all they're doing, they're hiding the ball and they want to be rewarded that we hired the ball. We're not going to tell you anything about how the interest was calculated. We're going to get there and make a bald-faced statement that has no support in the summary judgment, that they got every benefit of everything under the note, and there's no way for the court to know that. There's no way for me to know that. As far as the attorney's fees, they are, again, different causes of action. He did not segregate them. The court may not like my language on segregation because, again, I know the case law that talks about segregation between recoverable cause of actions and non-recoverable cause of action, but I use that terminology because that's what fits in my mind. Because the cause of action, is there a recoverable attorney's fees on a cause of action against Green Meadow to recover attorney's fees for when you sue EnergyCo? I don't know of any. Documents sure don't say that. Is there a cause of action against Green Meadow to recover attorney's fees when you sue EnergyCo? not any that I know of. So what you look at, I think, is like every case I've ever done when there's been multiple defendants like that, one of the ways you segregate them is just by dollar amount. There was more than four or five times, between four and five times, owed by Energeco is what they're saying is owed by Green Meadow. They did no attempt to segregate that. So for that reason, we'd ask the court reverse and render the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We appreciate your argument. Thank you, Mr. Berry. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing as well.